This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th, and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may have heard a lot about the amazing and interesting new documentary, The Aristocrats, which I think is as much an appreciation of the exercise of craft and show business as anything else. Its creators, Penn Jillette and Paul Provenza, are here. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And would you say that was kind of a pen?
In general, it's about the craft of show business, and a little more specifically, it's about improvisation. It all started with a long conversation about bebop, you know, the real, you know, Dizzy and Miles and Coltrane and Mingus, and talking about when they were doing solos, improvising in real time, how much of that was knowing the scale structure, how much of that was quotes from other things, how much of that was stuff they'd thought about in advance, and how much was really happening in real time, and how improvisation is a whole combination of flow charts and inspiration and skill all going on at once. And that led to other areas of improvisation, the area that we know the most about, which is comedy. And I think it was Provenza that first said, you know, you hear musicians improvise over the same song, but you never hear comedians tell the same joke. And it started out as a really very much a hobby. We just went to friends of ours with, you know, consumer cameras and just had them tell the same joke.
Paul, when did you first hear the joke? Do you remember?
I first heard the joke back when I was a baby comic at the New York Improv. I must have been 20, 21 maybe. Just started doing it after thinking about it for a long time. And I remember the night that I first heard it was a group of us huddled in this booth at the Improv. And the energy at that time was amazing. And people throwing ideas back and forth. And it was palpable. And at some point, some reference was made to the Aristocrats. And I said, I never heard the Aristocrats. What's that? And somebody turned around and, you know, said to everybody else, hey, Provenza's never heard the Aristocrats, and all the gathered around, and I believe it was Rick Overton, who's also in the movie doing a version of the joke, who started this, and then it became a round robin. And so it was one of those things that to this day still sort of resonates for me as a moment that typifies this camaraderie that became, you know, part of my life.
And that, when you're talking about jazz improvising, Penn, it's also in that way that those musicians were playing for the musicians too. That joke was kind of an in-joke for the comedians, wasn't it?
Very much so. You know, bebop comes out of the guys in the big bands getting together after the major shows and just kind of stretching out, trying to find what else they could find. And this joke, especially in the days of vaudeville, less so now, but in the days of vaudeville, when you had to work so squeaky clean for the crowd, and when people had their 12 minutes that they did for, you know, 25 years, those same 12 minutes working the circuit, this was a way to get back with your friends and stretch out and do stuff that could not in any way be done on stage, wasn't part of your act, and also wasn't acceptable for what your job was in those venues.
It's interesting for me, Paul, seeing George Carlin, who was one of the first guys really sort of break these barriers of language on stage, tell the joke, because it kind of shows, too, that he started off as one of those guys as well before he sort of took a literal left turn away from that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he worked very, very mainstream, and actually in a lot of ways being free with the joke like that sort of typifies a huge epiphany for Carlin in terms of his artistry and his creativity. And it was also very important for me that he be in the film because he was the single most important influence on me. When I was a kid, the first experience I had doing stand-up was when I used to, at the Bronx High School of Science, I used to have to make announcements at lunchtime and to get everybody to listen to my little nonsense announcements about what's coming up, you know, on the schedule for student activities. I would do routines word for word off of George Carlin's albums. And that's actually how I cut my teeth. It's the first time I had the chance to work in that vernacular. And so George Carlin was very important to me, and watching him grow through the years. You know, many years ago he said that he wished that he could be the kind of artist that he admired, like Lenny Bruce, and I think that he's accomplished that. So it was really, really meaningful that he's in the movie and actually became a spine. And it's funny because we were shooting all these people over a number of years, and then when we finally got Carlin in the can, I remember leaving Carlin's office after having shot it, and Penn turned around to me and he said, "How did that go?" And I said, "Now we have a movie."
Yeah, we didn't really consider it to be a movie until George Carlin said yes. And then we said, well, maybe this could actually be for more than just us. And then after we shot Carlin, it was very clear that the information that George gave us and the feeling George gave us was going to allow this to be a movie that might be seen by someone other than us. George also, when I first told him the idea on the phone, he made me make a promise, which is a promise that I'm sure I didn't need to make, and I'm sure we were going to keep, and I'm sure we wouldn't have done differently. But all the same, I'm glad he made us make it. And that was, he said, do not take a penny from anyone until you are finished editing. Don't let anybody else in on this. Do it all yourselves. Otherwise, you're selling us all out. You know, it's one of those things where we made that promise, and yes, of course, and I look back on it and go, yeah, I mean, when people called us and said, we heard you got a lot of comedians, let's give you some money and try to make this a studio project, we said, no, absolutely not. We were able to say, no, absolutely not, because we promised George Carlin.
Talking about this new movie, The Aristocrats, which is certainly provisionally about the world's dirtiest joke, its creators, Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette, here. How does this joke actually play for audiences? I mean,
I wouldn't know because I've never, aside from the pieces that are in the movie, Lisa Lampanelli, who performed it in front of an audience for the sake of us, and Gilbert, who did it at the Friars Roast, I've never actually seen it performed for an audience. It's not something that comedians do on stage. First of all, as Carlin says in the movie, who tells jokes on stage anymore? People do more personal material. They do routines. You know, the days of the Borscht Belt comedians, or that sort of generation of comedian that was a little bit closer to the vaudeville tradition, where they would rehash material and stuff like that. There was a time when somebody could write a great comedy act and then actually sell it to somebody else and just work different circuits, you know, and it would stay the same. It was like sheet music. You just give it to somebody else. But those days are long gone, so people don't really tell jokes on stage anymore. This is a joke that remained in private backstage, just being passed around, because we will pass around really funny jokes. We tell each other jokes and crack up, and there are many of us, you know, who like to deconstruct those things and enjoy them. I mean, you spend an afternoon or an evening after a show with myself, Paul Reiser, Rick Overton, and Larry Miller, and you know, we're like physicists with jokes. We love getting into the pen as well. It's, you know, just love getting into the minutiae and looking at all the angles and stuff like that. And this is a joke that's just survived, but we tell it to each other, to, you know, to people that hadn't heard it before, and also when we're in the mood to just sort of cut loose and see if we can, you know, if we can charge each other and juice each other and just get a nice volley going and stuff like that. It's not a joke that was ever intended for public consumption, and it's referred to as a secret handshake, but de facto, not by design. It's just because when you work with language freely, when you work with ideas, when you have no boundaries in terms of language or ideas as part of your art form, you learn very quickly that outside of like-minded people, it's often a mistake. You know, you don't tell this joke over the turkey at Thanksgiving dinner. You know, you don't tell it to your pals in the office when anyone else is in within earshot. I mean, you really got to know your crowd. You know, you got to know who you're talking to. And so this joke has just sort of stayed behind the scenes just because it's easier. That's really why it never really got out to the public.
It's possible that it takes about 89 minutes to explain to a lay audience what this joke really is.
It really does. But while we're talking about the joke and the movie The Aristocrats, with its creators Penn Jillette and Paul Provenza, it is for me, because I didn't know the joke until I saw the movie either, and I consider myself to be kind of sophisticated about this stuff. But it really serves as kind of a sort of history of the 20th century history of comedy.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, George Carlin said, well, George Carlin said two things. I called him up and I said, you know, jazz musicians do this, and we're going to do this with comedy. And Carlin paused for a moment and said, you're not smart enough to get this idea. You're just not smart enough. Someone else should have gotten this idea, but I'll be there watching over, trying to make you not screw it up. That was his vote of confidence. And then he said, what you're doing is a snapshot of comedy at the turn of the century. And be very aware of that and very careful.
It's funny, too, because as you said, having so many people tell the joke, I wonder if there's a certain point you guys thought this really, besides what Carlin said to you, we do have a movie here because it really is so much about tracking comedy over the 20th century.
Well, eventually we just had to stop. I mean, we shot for 4 years, between 140 and 150 hours of footage, and we could have kept going on and on and on. And at some point, we just had to say, we're going to move on. And at that point, we had what we had.
There was a great deal of willpower involved in the making of the movie, the going to friends of ours that we respected and loved with cameras and laughing for a couple hours and then taking it and throwing the tape in a closet was tremendously fun. And we had 40 people that said yes that we wanted to do, that the schedule just didn't work out. And I think that it really took a lot of saying, no, we really should finish this for other people, or we could have easily gone another 10 years and just kept piling up tapes. As it was, we had 140 hours. Provenza went through the 140 hours and transcribed it by himself, every word on those tapes, and essentially memorized it and then played around with the ideas we've been talking about and the ideas that came out in it and just got it all clear in his head and then did about 18 months of editing after that. So we could have just kept going and just been the guys that, you know, 100 years from now, they would say, you know, there were some nuts that went around and talked to everybody about dirty jokes. We should look through some of that tape. It'd be like Lomax or something.
Did you think it was a good point?
I mean, not that Lomax was a nut, but he was.
Well, he was. No, he was an obsessive. And clearly for you guys, outside for you, Paul, this is certainly – it feels like kind of an obsession that you want to sort of get to what this was, didn't you?
Well, it actually is – I mean, it really is the culmination of you know, everything that's gone on prior to this point in my life. I mean, you know, as Penn says, the idea started with Bebop, but Penn – at the time was obsessed with jazz and has in the interim become a fine jazz musician. My interest in jazz is a little bit more of a drive-by impression. I know a little bit about it, enough to appreciate the metaphors. But as he would be talking about bebop, I just kept hearing comedy. I was thinking everything he's talking about bebop and jazz is my experience in comedy. You know, I think a great old joke, even just a great joke that you hear at a party, you know, we're really talking about the great oral storytelling tradition. You know, we're talking about real folklore, and we're talking about stuff that's worthy of an academic investigation or anthologizing.
It's an important point, though, doesn't it? It's hard to get people to take comedy seriously.
Well, absolutely. But if we set about to do that, that would just be really boring. So instead, we set about to just try and translate the experience of what all of this world has meant to us. But I mean, just an old joke that you hear at a party is, you know, deserves the respect, has all the craft, technique, heart, and soul of a great haiku. You know, I mean, a great joke is no different, in fact, perhaps a little more difficult to write because of its succinctness than an O. Henry story. You know, I mean, it's literature. It can be and is in many cases literature. And then you add the performance element into it and you get what really is almost like opera is sort of like the art form that encompasses all other art forms. That's really what you get with comedy. And so my passion in this project was also just to sort of take a look at this art form, because I don't think people understand it. I mean, I've grown up my whole adult life with comedians in the world of comedy. I know what's going on, and I know what these artists are doing. I know what they're going through. I know the depth of their intelligence, the breadth of their heart and soul, the vulnerability that they you know, engage in all the time. They're remarkable people, but nobody ever gives it, you know, a second thought. It's sort of disposable and pop and what have you, but they're genuine artists, you know?
We'll take a break and come back. I'm talking with the creators of the movie The Aristocrats, Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette. I'm Elvis Mitchell. No fingers here. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment, talking about The Joke and, more importantly, the documentary about The Joke, The Aristocrats, with the movie's creators, Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette. What were you talking about? You mentioned haiku, Paul, and just getting back to what you were saying, really, Penn, about rhythms.
The rhythms are very, very important, you know, and also the exact tone, not just choice of words. It's not really written. It's also sounds. It really is the singer, not the song. And it's wonderful how the places where people are using the exact same words, it's wonderful that the different tone of their voices and just the different characters they've set up. I mean, the Smothers Brothers, when you see the two of them standing side by side and interacting, it's wonderful how the joke just falls away and you get to see the Smothers Brothers. It's one of the reasons we really do throw the joke away. I mean, you would never, ever put the punchline of your joke in the title of the movie, and yet the punchline is the title, as a way to just ram down people's throats. We don't care about the joke. We care about the improvisers. We care about the people that are doing it.
The Smothers Brothers, it's interesting you brought them up, because I had a little dilemma when we were cutting that together, because the stuff around the Smothers Brothers' performance of the joke in the film I felt was such important information and just profoundly changes the experience if you have this information. So we were fortunate enough to be able to figure out how just to put a little bit of text on the screen. At one point, it comes up and says, Tommy knows the joke, and then it reveals that Dickie doesn't. And at that point, you realize, oh, my God, you know, what we're seeing here that looks and feels like a well-honed Smothers Brothers routine that has all the hallmarks of something they've been doing for 30 years is truly happening before your eyes. And Tommy knows the joke. Dickie doesn't even know where it's going. Dickie's never heard this joke before. And that little piece of information, I think, elevates that moment to a real extraordinarily interesting exploration.
And it's that, you know, sending signals across burning ships. You know, you can't tell how Tommy is telling Dickie exactly what to do. But it's very interesting because you've got a case of two people improvising and one doesn't know the tune, doesn't know the key, doesn't know how it ends, and yet knows the other performer so well that it's really hard to tell that.
And actually, and after a while, it becomes really about ownership, doesn't it? Kind of a proprietorship of this.
Sure.
Thing. Yeah. I mean, the idea is the basic idea that we were looking to demonstrate is that it's the singer, not the song. It doesn't matter, you know, what the joke is. We've given the most simple switch, the simple joke that you can have. Everybody understands it. It's not complicated, and we've given it to people to do with what they will. And every rendition of it is remarkably different and completely embraces who they are, their unique individuality. And that's what makes it interesting. And that is a metaphor for all of comedy, that, you know, you could write the funniest jokes in the world, but what is it that you bring to the table, you know?
The joke we're talking about is The Aristocrats. It's in the documentary, also called The Aristocrats. Its creators, Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette, are here. I was wondering, Paul, if you kind of felt like at a certain point it couldn't be any longer than, say, 90 minutes a movie, or had to find a length that's sort of sitting with it as long as you did.
I would like to give you some very sophisticated answer that involves the language of cinema, but the bottom line is I can't go longer than 90 minutes without having to take a pee. So I vowed that the movie would be no longer than 90 minutes.
One of the first cohesive rough edits that I got to see after Provenza had been in his little spider hole for a while was 2 hours and 20 minutes.
And did that feel way too long?
No. At 2 hours and 20 minutes, it was perfect. But seeing it at 90 minutes, it's just right, because that's the amount of time you want to laugh. And from an intellectual point of view, 2 hours and 20 minutes is absolutely fine. But none of that means anything if you're not laughing.
I'm glad you brought that up, Penn, because it feels to me, just in seeing it now, and I've seen it a couple of times at a couple of festivals, it feels like, in terms of architecture, that you got the perfect moment with the Friars Club sequence. You can talk about that a little bit.
I know we've talked about this. I know you think that we should have ended it there. But I'll tell you something interesting.
But first of all, tell the audience a little bit what that scene is, that what I'm talking about here.
Gilbert Gottfried was performing on a Friars Club roast for Hugh Hefner, and it was 3 weeks after September 11th. And Gilbert came out and Well, was fearless enough, frankly, to talk about the elephant in the room. And, you know, it was really, I mean, there was a question as to whether or not this roast should even take place, whether or not it was somehow disrespectful to go out and have a good night of laughs, you know, in the light of a tragedy that was so fresh in everybody's experience. And Gilbert went out there and began to do jokes around the phenomenon. And the audience, which is comprised primarily of professional comedians, backed off and they booed him and they turned on him and somebody was yelling out, "Too soon, too soon." And you can see on the tape Gilbert sort of stammering and struggling to his, almost like, you know, spastic movement of his fingers as he was trying to figure out where to go, what can I do? And he then launches into a rendition of The Aristocrats that absolutely tore the walls off the place. People were just going nuts. It was a fearless move because everybody knows this joke. It's a hoary old chestnut. And, I mean, to tell it to a room full of comedians would be like, you know, singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in a room full of Judy Garlands.
It's funny for me because it seems like such a perfect moment because Gilbert Gottfried is the comedian's comedian, and this is the comedian's joke.
Right.
So it seems like this,
right.
this actual
intersect. Seems like the perfect moment once somebody's already done it.
Right.
But if you're the guy, at the podium, that's not clear right away. What's really compelling to me about that moment is that there is a subtext that I'm not even sure that Gilbert is aware of, but it's so clear to me, which is that Gilbert, by pulling this joke out, he's slapping everybody else on the wrist and saying, "Don't you tell me what's offensive or where I've transgressed or that this is inappropriate." And by pulling out The Aristocrats joke, he unconsciously reminds everybody that that's what we're supposed to do. And it was almost like everybody kind of got back on track, you know? And it was really a wonderful moment.
It's a great climactic moment, too. We're talking about The Aristocrats, the movie, and the joke. Its creators, Paul Provenza and Penciletta here. I just sort of felt like that felt so much like an actual climax.
Right. And I'm going to tell you why there is a little bit, actually not very much more. But
right.
What happens after that, the Gilbert roast is an emotional climax. It is, there's something visceral about it. It has taken you on a journey to this place where suddenly you appreciate this experience in a particular way that is emotionally satisfying. But that would be a little bit disingenuous to leave it there, because the real interesting part of the journey is what follows, which is where now that you've gone through 80 minutes of learning about this joke, finding out what your boundaries are, getting comfortable with the fact that you're talking with people that don't have boundaries, seeing the varieties that they deal with, challenging so many notions about comedy and about culture and all that sort of stuff, and then you get to this place where it's so wrapped up in a nice, neat bow. The real idea was to go to the next step, which is where we begin to say, okay, you got all that, you're okay with that, you enjoyed that, you had a nice emotionally satisfying moment, now we're going to take you to another place and see really how you are about this. And we begin to get into areas that are very, very challenging for people. Even after all of that, they suddenly find the joke in a place where it starts to deal with different issues and raises very, very subtle and complex issues of boundaries and transgression and what have you. And that's where really it needs to go in terms of the ideas that we're laying out. Is that reasonable?
I would say so, because up until then, people say, you know, I'm okay with this. I'm cool. I'm all right. And up until that point, there is a historical element. And what we do after the Friars roast is deal with racial issues more, which is much more taboo in the PC world. Certainly not taboo to have racism, but to address that.
I'm glad you wrote that up, Penn, because that's something, that great moment that for me that Chris Rock brings up. There is the difference between black and white culture.
It's astonishing. Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Well, we get asked a lot why there is Whoopi and there's Chris Rock, and those are the only blacks in the movie. That's it for African Americans. And we asked, you know, we have a lot of friends, and we talk to them and say, you know, we're doing this thing, and it was absolutely blank looks. And it's the culture, because the culture, even now, The Aristocrats is a joke that has a slight period feel, because now things have opened up enough that you don't have that hiding. And Chris Rock just said it so beautifully that, you know, it's the one sentence really in the movie from Chris Rock, talk, and yet it explains that whole difference. He just says black comics did not have a chance of getting on TV. They weren't working vaudeville. They were working the Chitlin circuit, and they weren't ever going to get there. So the idea of not being able to be dirty did not exist in that culture. You could do anything. While Lenny Bruce was breaking out and doing this stuff in New York, Red Fox had been doing it forever. You know, Moms Mabley had been working forever. You know, all these comics were doing all this stuff. It was completely accepted in their culture. And oddly, it was the only thing they weren't getting arrested for. and Lenny takes the hit for that really years later. So when we would talk to them, you know, the guys in the Kings of Comedy and all those guys, they would say, we'd love to do it, but you're really going to walk us through it because it doesn't mean anything to us.
Because, you know, the whole idea was that, well, they could do that stuff on stage. They could do that. They were getting down and dirty with their people on stage, you know. So why would that even register for them? There was nothing interesting about that particular joke. They weren't venting anything.
Because for me growing up, you know, you always had party records, which is what they were called.
Right. Sure.
And Red Fox did like 60 of them or something, all with the same cover.
No, sometimes with a different color, but it's the same photograph.
Color, same
color,
same
different color
drawing.
Graphics, right. But yeah, it's the exact same.
And what Richard Pryor did was move that with a sensibility and an intelligence and a really bridged the two cultures and moved across there. Now, we're talking a lot about George Carlin, and the only reason we're not talking about Richard Pryor is he was too sick to be in the movie. And we called and talked, and not to Richard because he has a great deal of difficulty, but to his wife and the people around him and explained the idea. And the message that we got back is he was so flattered we thought of him, which is insane. Who is the first one you're going to think of? It's going to be Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Johnny Carson, Buddy Hackett, Rodney Dangerfield. And the time we made the movie, just couldn't use those. You know, I called Buddy Hackett, and he talked to me about the joke for 15 minutes and told several different versions and went, yeah, it's the exact right idea, but I'm too old and sick. I can't be in it. Had the same conversation with Rodney Dangerfield. And Johnny Carson was writing emails going, this is my favorite joke. You're doing great stuff. But he was retired, and there was respect to not go, please, please, please. And we had promised to go to his home in Malibu after Sundance and show it to him. And as you know, he died while we were at Sundance. He died the day after the screening that you saw. But we have this movie where people say, you know, it kind of is middle-aged white guys. We just go, yeah, that was the culture of vaudeville, you know? Yeah, because you had a lot of people that were excluded from that. They were excluded from that. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we actually thought about putting in some comics just so that we wouldn't get busted for that. And that is such a horrible racist lie to say, please do us a favor so that people don't say, where are the black comics? And yet, you know, Chris Rock and Whoopi are good choices because they really address that.
It's perfect. It helped the movie to make sense to me, too. And I want to thank you guys for being here. Thanks for doing the show.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
It's a great movie for students of comedy, for students of show business, for people who just want to laugh. The film is The Aristocrats, and its creators, Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette, are here with us. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Our technical director at KCRW is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Maciek Wojcik at Carnegie Studios in New York. Bob Carlton is the editor. Mary Holtz is the producer. Go take a minute and laugh. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.